I'm Christopher Lighton in a farewell conversation with the school reformer, Ted Sizer. Until his death this week of cancer, Ted Sizer lived out the notion that if the fundamentals at Harvard, Yale, and Phillips Academy at Andover were good enough for him and his kids, they should and could be the model for public schools all over America. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude from the Watson Institute at Brown University, where Ted Sizer ran his Coalition for Essential Schools. He wasn't about gimmicks or even about theory. Small school, eye contact education for every kid was his standard, to be delivered by hands-on teachers until kids could speak and demonstrate all they'd learned. Ted Sizer practiced those ideas on me when he was just out of the Army and I was a scared, impoverished kid in high school. He taught a lot of us to feel good about doing the work. And then he went on to run the Harvard Ed School and Andover and his own startup charter school in rural Massachusetts. Last year, when he was ill but zesty, we talked with Ted Sizer at his home in the woods of Harvard, Massachusetts, about what he had taught and what he had learned about American schools. Ted Sizer, you're a byword for doing something serious to change and improve and enrich public education in this country. What's the view from the Sizer Olympus these days?
Well, I'm a curious advocate for public schools or interpreter of public schools, as I spent so much of my career in non-public schools in this country and in Australia. And in a curious way, those experiences taught me a lot about public education.
If my memory is right, you got the job running Phillips Andover because the New York public school system wouldn't hire you. Is that right?
They were interested in hiring me to do a job I didn't want to do, which was to sit in some office and give orders. And I'm sure that's important, but I didn't want to do it. I like being among the kids and the other teachers and all of that.
I interrupted you. You were giving the big picture of education and education reform. Seems to me a strange sort of silence about it nowadays. Did we solve the problem or did we just turn away from it?
No, there isn't a silence, as you imply, but there's plenty of noise on a variant on the issue, and it's called No Child Left Behind. That piece of legislation, very well-intentioned, which has particularly in recent years I've been turned into a hammer and supposed to hammer everyone into shape. This is what you do. No child will be not left behind because you teach them X, Y, and Z, and that's not going to work. And so it's particularly at the high school level. I can't speak for the elementary school level. I know enough about it to know I don't know enough about it. But at the high school level, there is because of No Child Left Behind, ironically, a growing movement for new kinds of schools. That the way to get away from the self-righteous imposers is to create something quite different. And I don't know what that is. That's what I'm working on. And I'm working on it largely by listening to smart people, traveling around. I've been able, through my association with the Coalition of Essential Schools, which is a school reform organization, to have entree to all kinds of places, different places all across the country, and people who will tell me the truth. And write me the truth. So I'm in the middle of raking through all of this and looking back for precedents.
Ted Sizer, you created an amalgam of the thoughtful, critically alive, questing teacher. His name was Horace Smith, and he got you through three books. So you got him through three books of reflections on the American high school. Right. What is Horace Smith up to today in 2008? What's he thinking about? What's he worrying about? What's he doing?
what Horace Smith is worrying about is how to cope with the current political climate, which is so unfairly critical and so driven by outmoded things like standardized tests. He worries about what's like for children to grow up in households where both parents, even if they're both parents are there, have to work. And a lot of one-parent homes, usually mother-only homes, and that the for many kids, the only hot meal they get in the day is at school, the only place where they have teachers who are adults who care about them in ways that the kids understand the caring. This is where I learned so much from Deborah Meyer, one of the reasons she started small schools in East Harlem, in great big buildings where there were other schools, so she did it the hard way, was that they should be treated as civilized younger citizens, and they should be given a thorough dose of what they needed to get in order to make it in high school and then beyond.
Stay with Horace Smith. What is he observing about the kids themselves today, about popular culture, about reading appetites, about professional or lifetime ambitions in his students? What is he noticing about the people he teaches with?
Well, he notices that the kids are fascinated by the apparatus of the popular culture, and they're seduced by it. They play with their Palm Pilots in class. They have all sorts of things there. That's very distracting. But Horace Smith, he worries about their families and what they go home to. He's worried about what they're listening and what they do. He's worrying about whether higher education will treat them properly or will just sort them out with admissions committees. They worry about the need for a resurgence of small public colleges, not the great big ones, but the small ones, the regional ones, the ones such as that in Fitchburg, where Nancy and I spend a good deal of time, marvelously led Fitchburg State College, mm-hmm. drawing a population of largely low income, and a graduate population of people on their way up. And you sort of feel like you're back in the early 19th century, early 20th century, late 1900s of the Horatio Alger types. Mm. So we can do it. And we work together. We don't compete with each other, but we see ourselves as a new wave.
Mm. What is Horace thinking about the competitive value of his students in a global economy?
He doesn't think enough about that. Hmm. He doesn't think about the Chinese or the Japanese, or of what's happening even in places like Tunisia, Algeria. It's just not where he's focusing. But that's again back to the job of the universities. The universities should do that thinking for us and have people who understand our world with all its necessary blinders, or what we consider to be necessary blinders, and get us on our terms, or terms which we will find convincing, to think about this broader issue.
Horace was always interested in what knowledge is valuable. There's so much to know, infinitely more than we can. He was always interested in what's selected, what's given importance. What is he thinking today about the content of an American high school education?
Well, what I hear and what I see in the work of this Coalition of Essential Schools with schools around the country is quite conservative. It's the there's language, our own, and at least one other. There is social studies, our own history, but those of others. There's math and science, which are easier to define, and then there's art, and that's the most difficult to define. So we spend at our little school a great deal of time explaining the importance of visual and performing arts. And in the public exhibitions, the kids show off their grasp and understanding of the importance of these. Hmm. So I think there is a long way to go, but we're getting there. And then you find in all sorts of places, like the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, really newly revived programs for children and adolescents. We visited these places, and it's a different conversation than when we used to go.
What does your friend Horace Smith think about digital culture, which is so much of what his students have now? Screen culture, yeah. High speed, global, democratic, sometimes junky, but electrically compelling state of mind.
Well, it's a massive, ever-changing library. There is all sorts of material out there in different forms, audio, video, print that you can get at. Expands the possibilities of a traditional education, and you can be completely by yourself. You can be Thoreau, and you still. But unlike the situation for Thoreau, you have at hand this enormous source of information and inspiration, some of which is full of misinformation and all that, but the earliest texts were full of deliberate misinformation and brainwashing.
Hmm. It's a fascinating idea that modern technology is delivering a kind of 19th century hope of the learned men and the aspiring globalists of that time.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's very refreshing that they are looking back in a constructive and critical way. I wish that our governments, state and federal, would do the same in other fields.
Hmm. Ted Sizer, almost all of your ideas are the most old-fashioned sort of American pragmatism and common sense. Spell them out, though. What do you think were the main ones, and where did they come from that you brought to school reform?
Well, the main ideas I came upon as an historian, not only primarily of American history, but also of British and Commonwealth history, which were part of my PhD requirements. And I was subjected to written and oral exams, so it was a really rugged, typically Harvard effort, no expense spared. And my marvelous advisor, Bernard Balin, who now is a retired university professor at Harvard, he would always say, well, do it again. And I also had the advantage of having a visiting professor from where was he from? Anyway, somebody who was not sort of soaked in Harvard and could say, well, you know, there's another way of defining this work and another way of expressing it. And Harvard allowed him to be part of the effort, and Harvard allowed two distinguished psychologists to be part of my committee. I mean, philosophers, not psychologists. One psychologist, Jack Carroll, but Robert Ulich and Israel Scheffler, who are these very thoughtful and devoted scholars who would ask the questions over and over and over. And again, saying, do it again, do it again, do it again, till you get it right, right by my standards. And if they're your standards, then you've learned something. So I was lucky.
But is this the core of Sizer's lesson, which is to say, you don't know it until you can perform it in a way, and you can't perform it until you've done it over and over and over?
Yes, absolutely. For everybody, even the so-called swiftest student, who may be the sloppiest, who will say something that seems so plausible, you forget to challenge it. And when you challenge it, you find he can't explain where it came from. He just, you know, came with his toast in the morning. But that whole process slows everything down. You can't do it all. So you focus on the process at the expense of the content.
Ted Sizer, what did you learn about public education watching your own kids grow up? Where did you send them, and what did they learn?
Well, we moved to Phillips Academy. That's what we did, and that was a good school for three of them during their 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th grades. A different kind of smaller, more progressive school was better for one of our kids. He came back and did a postgraduate year at Phillips Academy, and it was just what our kids needed, a rigorous traditional education in the best sense, taught by a then quite young, on average age, faculty, which was full of beans and marvelously arrogant. I mean, they knew they had the best school in the world, and they knew that the kids should be lucky they were there. Mm-hmm. And this kind of, you know, I am a member of the Boston Red Sox organization, and there is nothing to even measure or worth measuring to suggest that even the New York Yankees have anything to offer that we offer. So there's this marvelous arrogance.
I had forgotten, frankly, that you, like the Bush family, were sort of prisoners of Andover. If you had to find public high schools for your kids doing it today, or maybe your grandchildren, where would they go?
They would move to they would check out in the regions where they lived, the school districts that could serve, and if it was possible, they'd move to those communities where the schools were. Yeah, most families can't move, so there isn't the opportunity, but also the pressure on these systems that you find in strange places. The Federal Hocking High School it was a rural district in a very low-income rural district in Ohio. Mm-hmm. And the principal, half-time principal, his name is George Wood, and the other half, he's a professor at Ohio State, and he commutes. And he never sleeps, as far as I could see. But there is this the same kind of commitment, the same kind of understanding of the pressures involved and pride in it that you find in private schools of the right kind.
What's the secret? Can you share it?
Secret's in the faculty, the adults. If there is a secret, it's in the faculty. The kinds of people who get into this game, who stay with it, who believe in it, have a passion about it, have zeal even about it. And without that, you can't do anything else. Then you add to that, so way down a list, with the persons being the only thing at the top, are very good libraries, very supportive communities, from parents to the police department, and settings where the you know, knee-jerk use of force is not... is not the only game in town.
Ted Sizer, you make a wonderful connection. I don't know how many other people do, between the best of our past and our future if we get there. You're fascinating.
Well, let us pray.
I like your dedication of one of your last books. You wrote it for your grandchildren, and you said, may their schools deserve them.
Yes, that was, both Nancy and I did that book, as I recall. That was heartfelt, is that, of course, just like your grandchildren, they're very special. And any school which is privileged to enroll them should be very understanding of the nature of that specialness. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's the way I feel about media, about politics. If only all of our institutions could tap more faithfully into the incredible vitality of ourselves individually, the infinitude of the private man, as Emerson said, okay. But that... And an extraordinary American piece of it, too, would do a lot better.
I'm hopeful on those grounds.
Ted Sizer, there's a generation, a cadre of so-called TED heads out there doing great work in schools all over the place. What's the instruction to the troops who mean to carry this banner?
Realize that it's a temporary banner and that... what's right for the immediate time that I'm in now may not be right for the immediate time is a decade from now. So both in terms of government activity, in population shifts, and in the impact of the media. So the trick is to keep a few fundamental ideas about learning and about democracy alive and in your mind and apply them in ways that make sense for that future time.
Do you want to spell them out, the few basic ideas?
Each child's mind is to be respected. Each child's family is to be respected, family broadly defined. The people generally... through elected committees or appointed committees that have electoral support, are held publicly accountable for their work, that it is transparent. There's no backdoor deals unless those are necessary to protect the reputation of otherwise innocent people. That the other institutions that support education are reinforced, the media, libraries, the rest. Mm-hmm. It's a very predictable list. Mm.
Yeah, may their tribe increase, the TED heads, that is.
Yeah, no, whatever you call them, I hope their tribe increases.
Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation with Ted Sizer at home in Harvard, Massachusetts last year. Ted's wife, Nancy Faust Sizer, made us lunch that day. She'd been a partner in all of his schools and his writing to the end. You can link to Ted Sizer's work and to other estimates of it. You can add your own at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you, Ted Sizer, and thanks to all for joining the conversation.